Feels a bit like snow today. Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, The Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. This program is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical, folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. And who knows? It might even snow.
I hope there's a blizzard and we get a lot. That's what I'm wishing for. I'm anticipating, I'm not exaggerating. A month, maybe two or more. So weather reports that it's coming our way. There's one thing that I know. We'll have no school tomorrow or maybe for a week. So come on, bring on.
And that was the Alfred Choral Group, Bring on the Snow. Our musical trivia questions come to us today from the Seattle Times and the Chicago Tribune. Question number one, what holiday song has sold the most copies in single and album form since 1940? Was that A, White Christmas, B, Jingle Bell Rock, C, Let It Snow, or D, the Chipmunk song, Christmas Don't Be Late? And question number two, in the song Santa Baby, what does singer Eartha Kitt ask Santa to slip under the tree for her? Is it A, a gift card, B, Cadillac, C, Sable, or D, chocolates? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from the website onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of December the 10th. Well, it was on this very day, back in 1803, that French romantic composer and conductor Louis Hector Berlioz was born. Berlioz turned his back on a career in medicine to follow his passion for music and went on to compose works that showcase the innovativeness and search for expression that were hallmarks of Romanticism. His well-known pieces include the Symphonie Fantastique, Hector Berlioz, born today in 1803. And it was 37 years ago today, 1984, that the single Do They Know It's Christmas was released by the group Band-Aid. That group was assembled to aid in famine relief, created with the sole purpose of raising funds for the people of Ethiopia. This track featured cameos from famous pop faces, with everyone from Bono to Boy George taking part. After achieving a Christmas number one that year, the track went on to be the fastest-selling single in UK history, only being beaten off the top spot when Candle in the Wind, 1997, was released following the death of Princess Diana. 100% of all publishing revenues from this sale of the song over the past 35 years and continuing, and amounting to tens of millions of pounds, have gone directly to the Band-Aid Trust for distribution to projects that aim to help the poor in several countries in Africa. Do They Know It's Christmas? Released today in 1984.
Skyscrapers shine the sun so low in the sky. The secretaries at the hot dog vendors, cabs honk at the bicycle messengers.
And from this capital city, how about this for a music-themed gift? Mark Kennedy, Associated Press, writes on 11/11/21 that singer-songwriter Graham Nash of the country rock band CSNY has been taking photographs longer than he's been making music. His collection of images over the years, A Life in Focus, the photography of Graham Nash, captures unguarded celebrities including Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Mama Cass, and of course, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Out November 30th, 2021, $60.
You wouldn't like it here.
And in classical music news, we have this article titled, Lately We've Read, Niccolò Paganini, His Life and Work, a book written by Stephen Samuel Stratton and reviewed in WCPE's Quarter Notes Winter 2021-22 issue by Gracelyn Hyman. Stephen Samuel Stratton's biography of Niccolò Paganini is both readable and informative. One of the most appealing features of this book is Stratton's use of direct quotations in his unbiased presentation of his subject. There are many legends about the great violin virtuoso. One of the most familiar is, of course, that Paganini must have been in league with the devil in order to have developed such remarkable skill with his instrument. In the early 1800s, this was a serious accusation. Paganini countered it by publishing a letter from his mother, which made it clear that he was not the son of the devil. Stratton provides us with the text of this letter. It is especially delightful to read the reactions of contemporary composers Frédéric Chopin, Ignaz Moscheles, and Louis Spohr, as well as critics when they heard Paganini in concert. Stratton provides us with excerpts from newspapers and magazines, journals. The book is replete with engrossing images, drawings, paintings, and statues of the great Genoese violinist, photos of original concert bills, and finally, pictures of the house where he died in Nice and the tomb where he is interred in Parma. Stratton is careful to provide a balanced view of Paganini. We learn that he was criticized for the high prices he set on his concert tickets, but also of his many performances for the benefit of the poor. Paganini had little formal education other than in music. However, he developed his own financial accounting system and kept those records in a little red book under his pillow. The final chapter of the book not only lists Paganini's extant compositions, but also describes each of them in detail, including works that have been lost. In earlier chapters, Stratton developed meticulous attention to Paganini's performances of his own pieces during his career. Ever the shrewd businessman, the virtuoso played his own works almost exclusively in concert. I found this book about the most famous violinist of all time, who counted Lord Byron, Prince Metternich, Giacomo Rossini, and Hector Berlioz among his friends, to be just as engaging as Niccolò Paganini himself. This book is available in a variety of electronic formats, paperback, or, if you prefer, in a gilt-edged leather-bound edition. And in music research and technology, need a suggestion for a stocking stuffer gift? How about a speaker that reads the room? This is listed under the article titled 100 Best Inventions of 2021. This one's written by Don Steinberg, published in Time magazine on the 29th of November, 2021. Sing, spelled S-Y-N-G, founder Christopher Stringer spent 22 years at Apple, where he helped design the iPhone, iMac, and other iconic products. Now he's hoping for another hit with his Cell Alpha, $1,799, a wireless design-forward speaker that produces audiophile-quality sound. During setup, the Cell Alpha, which resembles Star Wars' Death Star, uses tones and microphones to calibrate itself to the shape and acoustics of the room it's in for maximum oral quality. Then bass booming woofers and drivers emit a sound that seems to come from all directions. Move it, and it'll automatically perform a new sound check. If you have two, they'll calibrate to each other. And also in music research and technology, but with connections to local music news, we have this article titled, When Making Music Breaks Your Body. For rock duo The Dodos, a dream job packed a hidden cost. They're far from alone. This is published in NPR.org by Grayson Haver Curran, December the 4th, 2021. Merrick Long had been playing guitar for 3 years when he realized the instrument could be more than his hobby. It could be his way of communicating, too, of feeling he had something important to say. At a high school friend's house party, Long, then an anxious California teenager, smoked too much weed and meandered on an acoustic guitar for several uninterrupted hours. He assumed he was improvising for no one, but people listened, captivated by the sudden volubility of a 16-year-old who considered himself awkward and uneasy. I always thought if I say anything, I'm going to say something stupid, Long remembers with a laugh. I realized that moment is what it felt like to speak and have people value what you were saying. Even now, when he talks to other parents at the daycare of his 3-year-old daughter, Tegra, the guitar gives him something to discuss, a cool job as icebreaker. If I could walk into every socially awkward situation with a guitar, he admits, I would. When Long started the Dodos, his Bay Area duo with drummer Logan Krober, in the mid-2000s, that feeling was still driving him. Having fallen in love with finger-style guitar, playing the strings directly without the aid of a pick, in his early 20s, he resolved to take it to an unconventional extreme. He wanted for every string to sound like a different drum. As Long yowled quarter-life missives, he clawed and hammered the strings, with Krober throwing jabs at each drum like a welterweight bullying his opponent. Towards the end of the aughts, those punchy songs briefly made the Dodos rising indie rock stars. Their distinctive concerts, Long seated, his body unnaturally wrapped around the guitar like a tree swallowing an old metal sign, made them festival favorites, playing 100 shows per year at their peak. But despite the popularity and 7 full-length records, Long felt like he'd never truly captured his guitar the way he'd hoped. In August 2019, a month before his 39th birthday, he and his wife, Noella, had taken Tegra to Spain, and he'd been playing lots of guitar in the woods. He was working on Annie, a plaintive new number about seeking forgiveness from a doomed relationship, when his left pinky refused to stretch across the frets. I had experienced pain there before, but I had always forced myself through it, Long remembers. This just didn't hurt. It was a limitation. Back home in Oakland a month later, a blood test confirmed rheumatoid arthritis, an autoimmune condition with punishing effects on the joints. What's more, his decade-plus of aggressive guitar playing had almost certainly been quietly exacerbating the damage. I started writing down all the things wrong with me that I can attribute to playing in Superchunk, says Laura Balance, the North Carolina band's bassist for three decades. Balance quit touring in 2013 after dealing with hearing loss and hyperacusis, where certain sounds become incredibly grating. Her full index of ailments includes COPD, bone spurs in the neck, bunions in the feet, a crooked spine, and, she quips, self-diagnosed brain damage. She's been off the road nearly a decade, but the time away hasn't magically fixed her. Hearing woes means it's still hard to see bands live, hindering her ability to run Merge Records, the label she co-founded. Hearing loss and tinnitus, tendonitis and arthritis, mouth calluses, and vocal cord nodules, these are only a sliver of the vast collection of maladies a musical life can bring. A 2017 study of more than 700 orchestral musicians in Germany found that two-thirds of them endured chronic pain, many for at least 5 years. And while it's fairly well understood that music careers are an endurance sport, requiring rigorous practice and few days off, the physical consequences often go unadvertised, hidden from fans for the sake of shows that must go on. We all abuse ourselves for the sake of performance, but nobody talks about it, Balance says. I'm not the only one. Near the end of 1981, Max Weinberg felt like he might actually be the only person injured by making music. By that point, Weinberg had been the drummer in Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band for nearly a decade, earning the moniker Mighty Max for his gusto behind the kit. Weinberg noticed that the space between his thumb and index finger on both hands, where he gripped his sticks for 3 hours every night, ached, the sinew inflamed. At one point, he couldn't even open his hands at all, even when he pushed against the fingers. I had unusual demands as a drummer, playing at a very high intensity level, Weinberg says. There was an obsessive prejudice on the part of musicians to hide their injuries. You would suck it up, play through the pain, Weinberg remembers. No one was talking about it, so I took the spotlight of the E Street Band and shined on performance-related injuries. Nearly four decades later, 25-year-old guitarist Yasmin Williams encountered similar isolation and confusion when her right thumb began aching, locking, and spasming. She posted to social media wondering if other guitarists had experienced similar pain. Turns out most of my musician friends have had surgery or extended periods where they couldn't play or sing. We're treated like athletes who are supposed to just push through pain to make people feel entertained, Williams says. But talking about pain shows that you're real. Leo Kottke, the 76-year-old acoustic guitar titan, knows the shame such suffering can bring. Part of being a performer, he assumed, was working hurt. On a small stage in Denver, Kottke's right arm froze so that it felt like he was playing guitar with a baseball bat. He'd long used finger picks, small metal or plastic pieces worn on the fingertips that make it easier to strike a string, which meant his wrist was constantly turned inward, straining his forearm. Kottke dropped the picks to save his wrist. It seems almost counterintuitive for musicians to feel shame discussing their woes, since pain enjoys such a mythical stature in art at large, the impetus behind so many tormented masterworks. Frida Kahlo's splintered skeleton prompted many of her most acclaimed paintings. George Orwell endured the final stages of tuberculosis to finish 1984. Herman Melville's many ailments and the impact they had on his work, especially after Moby Dick, remain a topic of scientific debate. Similar stories poured from modern music, as the proof of our heroes possesses a tenacity we cannot comprehend. There was Neil Young's back pain, the partial source of Harvest's acoustic canter. There is Iggy Pop's battle-scarred body, a testimonial to the rigors of rock. There was Bjork's vocal polyp and her insistence that its surgical removal widen her range. When icons like Tom Petty or Prince die from painkiller overdoses, fans ascribe meaning to the tragedy, relief from the torment that allowed them to help us. When Long's pinky froze for the first time in Spain, he was confused, then angry, and soon more motivated than he'd ever been. Spurred by his arthritis diagnosis, he stopped drinking and changed his diet. But he also understood that the window for the Dodo's original quest to make guitar music in which each string sounds like a drum was rapidly closing. For 2 decades, finger-picking the guitar had been his identity. Knowing he might be on the cusp of losing that ability, he wanted to get it right. Long was so focused on pushing past pain and self-pity that the Dodos were nearly done recording Grizzly Peak before Kroeber learned of his bandmate's condition, let alone that many of these songs were tentative goodbyes to the band itself. But the drummer says he understood, having weathered his own Tiger Balm years, when performing entailed slathering so much of the Singaporean analgesic on his sore joints that he often smelled like a menthol manufacturer. Grizzly Peak, released November 12th, does make good on the Dodo's original aim. Its 10 songs suspend listeners like marionettes above the guitar's sound hole. Most every strum rumbling like a little earthquake. The album rumbles open with Annie, the song Long was writing when it all went wrong. But he always returns to the question of what he would be without the instrument. Who am I then? He remembers thinking. What do I have to add? If nothing else, arthritis may have given him an answer, a reason to see himself as more than a guitarist. The arduousness of recording this album has rippled into his work as an audio engineer, motivating him to help other guitarists sound great, and he has his family. Kottke understands Long's predicament and its possibilities. When he stopped using finger picks to stave off tendonitis, he realized he could feel the guitar's strings again, a change that has arguably made him a better player in time. Max Weinberg says he relearned how to hold his sticks and passed the lesson on to his son Jay, the drummer of Slipknot. Williams, the young guitarist, will soon get her first steroid injection, and she's developing the sort of warm-up routine Weinberg insists every musician should have for their sport of choice. Long's diagnosis may very well end the Dodos and prevent him from being a guitarist in the future, but it has allowed him to consider what else he is and can become. My fundamental relationship with guitar was so simple. Now that it's taken away, I realized it's okay if I don't have anything else to say with it, he says. I found other ways to talk without the guitar. So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, what holiday song has sold the most copies in single and album form since 1940? Was it A, White Christmas, B, Jingle Bell Rock, C, Let It Snow, or D, the Chipmunk Song, Christmas Don't Be Late? And the correct answer is, answer A, White Christmas. As noted in the Seattle Times, Irving Berlin's White Christmas, which was first recorded by Bing Crosby in 1942, is the holiday song that has sold the most copies since 1940. Songfacts.com adds, this 8-line song that paints a picture of holiday nostalgia was written by Irving Berlin for the 1942 movie Holiday Inn, where Bing Crosby sings it from the perspective of a New Yorker stranded in sunny California during Christmas. This won the Academy Award for Best Song of 1942. The song has been covered by such artists as Michael Bolton, Andy Williams, Lady Gaga, Elvis Presley, pianist Jim Brickman, and Clyde McFadder and the Drifters, among others. And the answer to our second question, in the song Santa Baby, what does singer Eartha Kitt ask Santa to slip under the tree for her? Is it A, gift card, B, Cadillac, C, Sable, or D, chocolates? And the correct answer is answer C, Sable. As noted in songfacts.com, Eartha Kitt was a sultry nightclub performer who earned a record deal with RCA in 1953. Trying to play up her image as a sophisticated vamp, RCA had her record a French song called C'est si bon, it's so good, which put her on the radar. At the end of 1953, Joan Javits, who was the niece of U.S. Senator Jacob Javits, wrote Santa Baby for Kitt with Philip Springer, and it became a holiday hit and Kitt's most famous song. Javits came up with the lyric, Santa Baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me, and Springer quickly came up with the music. Along with I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, this was one of the first Christmas novelty songs. Christmas songs written at the time tended to be nostalgic looks at the holiday or kids' songs, but this one took a different approach, with Kitt singing about how she'd been good all year and expects some very expensive gifts to appear, including a fur coat and even a yacht. This girl has expensive tastes. So let's ease into the holiday music season this December with Eartha Kitt asking for that sable to be slipped under the tree.
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. This program is also available as a podcast after the broadcast in our website, ncreadingservice.org. As we leave you now, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. If you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me at 919-832-5138. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Music Review, underwritten by Bill McClure, tuning pianos in the Raleigh area since 1968. For more information or to schedule a piano tuning, please call 919-779-1755. So long, until next time.
So hurry down the chimney tonight.